countless meetings. The position had been unfilled for 18 months, primarily because no senior State Department diplomat wanted to wet his shoes in the squishy peat bog of the spy world. But Ambassador Vano found liaison meetings with various intelligence agencies around town tolerably interesting, if not particularly demanding, and as the State Department rep, he was rarely asked to participate. The leper at the square dance, one NSA wit had muttered. He'd had intel briefs as chief of mission in Madrid, and found them thrilling, sort of like movie scripts. However, one day, Tommy Vano interrupted a discussion about strategic medals being purchased and hoarded by Moscow and Beijing, and casually mentioned that his consortium was familiar with the global commodities markets, government ministers, commercial buyers, extraction mines, and stockpiles. All of it. From that day, he had a seat at the table, and despite being more affable than discerning, was accepted as a subject matter expert. When the call went out for nominees for DCIA, the milk and water outgoing Secretary of State, who still believed in the code of conduct which held that gentlemen don't read each other's mail, proposed the Honorable Thomas Vano for DCIA, citing his business acumen, his foreign experience as a diplomatist, and his attributes as a current ambassador at large for intelligence, with deep ties to and contacts within the intelligence community. It was Washington speak to be sure and patent nonsense, but Vano made the cut for the final three. He was tall and bird-chested with a buccaneer's wavy black hair, limpid pools for eyes, and a Cary Grant cleft on his chin. Benford noted with interest that the sole visible respondent to Vano's money Hollywood sex vibe was EA Division Chief Neff, a known free spirit once referred to by the deputy of the Organized Crime Section and Counter-Narcotics Division as a habitual receiver of swollen goods. Senator Feigenbaum was too old and mean to care, and Admiral Rowland didn't move her gold stripes an inch and seemed oblivious. God preserve us, thought Benford. A harpy from the Hill intent on destroying the agency, an awkward physics blue stocking from the Navy, and a stuffed toy millionaire who, as ambassador in Madrid, thought the Basque terror group's acronym ETA stood for Estimated Time of Arrival. Benford had demurred in today's briefing session in the interest of time to discuss any Russian cases and was determined to stall for as long as possible. Magnet was still out there. Nash had just reported that GRU was gunning for Diva, and all hell was going to pop in Istanbul if they didn't do something immediately. Istanbul was going to be a disaster. The Wolverines. In Sevastopol. God help us. I hope they're as sharp as Forsyth swears they are. The first Cold War ended 30 years ago. We're fighting the second one now. Riojan Caparones Stew. Fry sliced chorizo and chopped onion and garlic in olive oil until soft. Add pimenton, hot Spanish smoked paprika, and red chili flakes and continue frying. Add chopped fresh tomatoes, water, vegetable stock, canned chopped tomatoes, and tomato paste. Bring to a boil, then simmer covered. Add chopped parsley and white beans, cannellini or navy, and continue simmering until thickened, somewhere between the consistency of a soup and a stew. Let stand an hour or overnight, and reheat to serve piping hot with a drizzle of olive oil and a poached egg floating on top. Chapter 16. The Wolverines. During the salad days of the Cold War, the breathless arrival and bustling Rome station of 1st Tour Case Officer Tom Forsyth, fresh out of training at the farm, was greeted variously by colleagues. A number of them helpfully showed Tom around Rome and pointed out the best trattorias for Roman cucina povera, peasant home cooking, and where to find a bottle of Chesanese del Piglio from Lazio. His branch chief got him on the invitation list for half a dozen National Day celebrations at foreign embassies where he could begin trolling for developmentals on his own. The report's chief sat him down and went over the target list so he'd know what to look for. Senior Rome Station Officer Gail Stack was 55 years old and close to retirement. Earlier in his career, he'd had opportunities at management, but it hadn't worked out due to competing priorities that included 3 martini lunches, creative accounting on his Ops Revolving Fund, RF, and chatting up bar hostesses. Stack resented that he'd never been appreciated for what he brought to the mix. He'd been stepped on and stepped over, plenty. The arrival of young Forsythe, they were in adjoining office cubicles, presented an opportunity for Stack to unload a bothersome case encrypted VZ Wolverine. It was going nowhere, at least not with the amount of effort Stack was willing to put into it. The asset, a young Polish emigre named Witold Zawadzki, had volunteered as an embassy walk-in, and Stack had elbowed other officers aside for the case. He thought it would be a gravy train, lots of intel for little work, as well as a nice line item on his RF for charging off lunches and dinners. VZ Wolverine was from an aristocratic family in Krakow, one of the Szlachta, the Polish nobility, dating back to 1360 and King Casimir III the Great. Sent to Rome as a boy to live with an aunt, Witold, now 25 and an Italian citizen, hated the Soviets only slightly less than he hated the Strajci, the traitor Poles who sold out their own country. At their first agent meeting, the firebrand young Pole, nervous, thin, blonde hair slicked back, looked intently at his white-maned case officer with the manicured fingernails, whose hand shook as he pulled the martini olive off a toothpick with his large white teeth. Witold leaned forward and told this CIA officer that he was willing to return to Poland, and that his family knew patriotic, like-minded Poles in the government, the party, and the military. Stack burped, signaled for another martini, and told VZ Wolverine to order anything he wanted off the menu, anything at all. At a second boozy lunch at the fabulously expensive seafood restaurant La Rosetta in the shadow of the Pantheon, VZ Wolverine brought a list of influential Polish families who would, with careful encouragement, provide information on Polish Communist Party leadership, Soviet intelligence activity in Poland, and Warsaw Pact military readiness levels. Putting down his lobster claw, Gail Stack took the paper with a butter-slick thumb, put it into his coat pocket, and told Witold he'd run traces on the names. Stifling his ready temper, VZ Wolverine told Stack that he wanted to talk to someone else in his organization. Alarm bell. Bad idea to let another station officer get his nose under the tent to see how Stack was expensing meals off this case. Never mind letting this wannabe freedom fighter complain about his handling officer. Stack the next day told the branch chief that VZ Wolverine was a bitter emigre, with no access to intel, and that he was recommending that Station cut the asset with a $1,000 termination bonus. He'd give the young man $500 and keep the rest as pocket money, and stop wasting time. The branch chief warily said okay, but something made him change his mind, and he told Stack instead to turn over the case to another officer, that maybe changing the chemistry would help. Alarm bell. An experienced station officer would see the real story and report back. Then Stack remembered that new kid Forsythe in the next cubicle. He wouldn't know the ropes yet, he'd be perfect. How about it? Asked Stack. Easy case to cut his teeth on, push the asset to develop access, nice and slow. The branch chief shrugged and said to go ahead. That was the start of the Wolverine Network. After a bibulous turnover meeting, Tom Forsythe and his new agent Witold Zawadzki warily began to feel each other out. Witold saw that his new rookie case officer was honest, energetic, and driven to be successful. Forsythe saw that the impatient young Pole's fierce commitment needed to be controlled. Nothing would be accomplished by running suicide missions. VZ Wolverine's return forays to Poland started slowly, covered as commercial buying trips for an Italian design company letting the SB, the Służba Bezpieczeństwa, the Soviet-controlled Polish intelligence service, get used to seeing the young man with the Italian passport come and go. After two trips, VZ Wolverine recruited a childhood friend, now a Polish army captain who was encrypted VZ Wolverine 2. Family friends VZ Wolverine 3 and 4, a comely former art student now special assistant in the party secretariat, and a police sergeant respectively, were acquired in the next 6 months. Witold's next recruitment was VZ Wolverine 5, his cousin, who was coincidentally a communicator in the headquarters of the Ministry of Interior, who processed KGB message traffic between Warsaw and Moscow. The intelligence streams started slowly. Reports were collected from those sub-agents by Wolverine 1 as principal agent and brought to Forsythe in Rome. Rome Station management sat up and started taking notice. Then headquarters followed. The reporting from Wolverines was superb, including photography of classified Warsaw Pact and Soviet Red Army documents never seen before. Counterintelligence analysts looked at the take with a skeptical eye. Too good to be true, intelligence always aroused suspicions, but the reports were corroborated, and they kept coming. Forsythe had to continually rein in Vitold to tell him to slow down to balance production against risk. In his continuing effort to protect his Wolverines, Forsythe trained Vitold in clandestine photography, impersonal communication, secret writing, and advanced intel reporting, who in turn trained his network members inside Poland. A month later, Vitold presented Forsythe with an audio tape of a closed meeting of the frantic Central Committee of the Polish Communist Party, arguing about whether to comply with or ignore an order from KGB Director Chebrikov to arrest fractious Wujek miners and Gdansk shipyard workers in the Solidarity Movement. Wolverine 3, the statuesque clerical assistant in the secretariat whose name was Agnes Krawczyk and who, alarmingly, was an adrenaline junkie, had stuck a microphone and small wire recorder, assembled by Wolverine 5, the electronics whiz named Jerzy, under the president's dais before the meeting. Even as he submitted the reports, subsequently graded a rare O for outstanding, Forsythe freaked. The Wolverines would not last if they kept taking the insane risks of the past months, he yelled at Vitold. And the use of two Wolverines in the same operation violated the tenet of keeping Wolverine network members compartmented from each other. It was risky enough that Vitold knew everyone's name. This had to stop. Over a holiday dinner of Zrazi Zawiyane, succulent roulade of beef with onion, mushrooms, and silky dark gravy, at his aunt's Rome apartment, Vitold smiled at Forsythe, how far they had come together, and said that given Forsythe's motherly concern, he would postpone for now his plan to kidnap the KGB resident in Warsaw and deliver him hogtied to Forsythe in time for Christmas. They toasted with a glass of Chopin vodka. In the 3 years of Forsythe's Rome tour, the Wolverine Network had produced hundreds of intelligence reports of high interest, and had informed Washington policymakers on the dangerous last throes of Soviet domination of Eastern Europe. Headquarters promoted Forsythe and presented the Medal of Achievement to Vitold. When the Soviet Union imploded in 1989 and Poland came back into the light, Forsythe proposed that his five Wolverines be kept together and on the active duty roster. He envisioned the team traveling as commercial reps for various Polish companies, selling machine tools, pumps, and software in denied areas. North Korea, Cuba, Iran, Russia. Countries murderously difficult for traditionally covered CIA officers. The statuesque Agnes Krawczyk, moreover, had joined the Faculty of Conservation and Restoration of Works of Art at the Academy of Fine Arts in Krakow, where she finally earned her degree as a licensed conservator of antique terracotta, plaster, and ceramic artworks. Forsythe envisioned operational foreign travel for Agnes with cover as a restorer of art. With relative freedom of movement in these countries, said Forsythe, the team could discreetly conduct required operational acts. The Wolverines had been trained over the years and were proficient in street surveillance, surreptitious entry, sight casing, recruitment, and intelligence reporting. All of them spoke fluent Polish and Russian, as well as the requisite French, German, and satellite proto-English. They were self-sufficient, aggressive, natural risk-takers, and fiercely loyal to Forsythe, who was like a god to them. Then, headquarters intervened. There was protracted bureaucratic wrangling over Forsythe's proposal for the Wolverines. The new breed of CIA leadership, mostly politically ambitious former analysts and administrators who for decades had resented the verve and the hegemony of the Directorate of Operations and now perversely sought to reform the DO into oblivion, viewed these five fanatic slobs, or whatever they were, as retro Cold War dinosaurs. Besides, collection in the modern age was shifting to drones and satellites and massive electronic listening posts. Classic human intelligence, such as an officer talking to a clandestine source, the one sure way to obtain the plans and intentions of the opposition, was atrophying as an overly dangerous and time-consuming method of collection. Most CIA bureaucrats, frantic to avoid operational flaps, wanted nothing to do with case officers, collectors, operators, cowboys, scalp takers, mustangs, old whores, headhunters, or five fucking Eastern European Wolverines, for that matter, who could create only blue ruin and wind them up in front of a congressional oversight committee. When it appeared that headquarters' ignorance and acedia would prevail, and that the Wolverines would be put out to pasture, a crisis arose in 2001 involving CIA employees in Syria. Three visiting analysts, two women and one man, from the Office of Near Eastern and South Asian Analysis, NISA, had ignored Damascus Station guidance to stay within the embassy compound in central Damascus on Abu Jafar al-Mansur Avenue. They were in Syria to gather ground truth on the Syrian civil war and thought they knew what they were doing. Two of them spoke rudimentary Arabic. They set out on a Tuesday morning intending to visit the offices of the International Red Cross on Arvada Square, the Italian Hospital on Omar al-Mukhtar Avenue, and the Souq al-Khoja on Al-Thara Street, a total round trip of 3 hours and 10 miles. When they did not return to the embassy at the close of business, the security officer called the Metropolitan Police, who several hours later found the body of one of the women in the eastern suburb of Jobar, on the ground floor of the burned-out teacher's tower building, a blackened 10-story shell amid rubble and rusted tanks with hatches flung open and tracks thrown off the drive wheels. The 46-year-old divorced mother of two had been wired in her maiden-form underwear to a rusted bedspring propped upright against a shrapnel-pocked wall, and a plastic cable tie had been cinched around her neck. With a shrug, police said it might have been rogue soldiers from the National Defense Forces, or Sunni-led insurgents, or a Hezbollah unit, who could tell, but they expected the torture tape would be delivered to the embassy in several days. That night, the security officer received a frantic call from the other two analysts. They had narrowly escaped being taken by running down an alley when their taxi had been blocked by two cars. They had flagged down an elderly man in a dented truck and offered to pay him to drive them to the embassy, but Hezbollah roadblocks and a thunderous explosion a block away had panicked the driver, who instead drove the protesting analyst to his house in the village of Az-Sabura, 8 miles west of the city along Route 1. The old man and his wife were terrified that local Islamist insurgents would discover the Americans and murder them all. The streets at night were full of roving armed bands of men in keffiyeh headscarves. The analysts were trapped, unable to move. They had water and had been fed. The old lady made a batch of karat barasia, a fragrant Syrian leek and lamb stew, to last the week. They spent the night on the couch listening to voices in the courtyard. They didn't have much time. Some neighbor eventually would notice and talk, or militants might search the houses. Complicating matters further was that someone in the police had whispered to the local Iranian Quds Force commander that two CIA officers were stranded and hiding somewhere in Damascus. The call went out from Tehran to compliant Syrian security organs, militia, and army units to find and apprehend the perfidious Americans who significantly were not accredited to the Syrian government and therefore had no diplomatic immunity. Despite repeated protests from the acting ambassador, Hezbollah roadblocks were set up around the U.S. Embassy. Station officers tried several times to get clear and drive to the village, but had to abort when they picked up heavy harassing surveillance. They stood down. At headquarters, the dire situation in Damascus was the first topic of discussion during the nightly director's executive review meeting in the 7th-floor conference room. The caliphs and Langley, who normally sat in the high-backed chairs waiting for orders from downtown, were gloomy. They had a dead analyst on their hands, and the possibility of losing two more would be no end of trouble. No one had any ideas, nor was anyone going to suggest a solution, and conversation withered. The dyspeptic silence was broken when now Chief of Europe Forsyth submitted to the collected leadership that his team of Polish agents could infiltrate Damascus without attracting attention, make contact with the two surviving analysts, and exfiltrate them out of Syria, probably west to Lebanon. There would be no contact with the beleaguered station. Faces around the table brightened. This was a solution on two levels. Either the analysts would be rescued, or the train wreck of a blown op could be blamed on Forsyth and his polka-dancing retinue. Three Wolverines flew into Damascus International via the intermittent Syrian air flight from Algiers, posing as representatives of the Polish Business Board looking for business opportunities in the new urban renewal projects, a cover that was marginally plausible given the growing devastation of the suburbs of Damascus. Two other Wolverines, including Forsyth's friend Vitold, traveled by jeep from Lebanon and staged in Jidat Yabus, a Syrian town 45 kilometers west of Damascus. It was 3 kilometers from the Lebanese border, the official border crossing. Vitold and his colleague arrived in a white Toyota Land Cruiser with the logo of Heritage for Peace on the door, a familiar organization dedicated to protecting World Heritage sites and antiquities in Syria. No locals paid them any attention. After a desultory call on the Ministry of Housing and Construction, the Wolverines in Damascus determined they were black and operated flawlessly. They located the house by geolocating the analyst's cell phones in As-Sabora with a K-9 unit, a CIA proprietary GPS satellite tracking system, operated from an innocuous 7-inch tablet and accurate to 5 meters. The exhausted analysts were shaken awake at 4 in the morning by VZ Wolverine 4, the Polish ex-police sergeant who somehow had entered the little house without a sound. They were bundled into a waiting car and driven north on Highway 1, where they met Vitold's Toyota at dawn. Transferring to Vitold's vehicle, the CIA analysts were given khaki field shirts and jeans, floppy hats, desert boots, and Belgian passports. Vitold then drove to the border, timing the crossing at noon, when truck traffic was heaviest and pot-bellied customs officers were thinking about lunch. One of the Syrian customs men fingered the alias Belgian passport of one of the terrified analysts and asked him a question in French, a language he did not speak. The swooning analyst instead threw up the remains of leek and lamb stew on the customs man's boots. Vitold ruefully explained that his colleague had drunk water from a stream below the last village and had been sick for the last 2 hours. Shaking his head at the Ajami, these non-Arabic barbarians, everyone knew to drink from streams before they ran through towns, the customs man waved them through. The analysts were on a Paris-bound flight from Beirut the next morning. The other three Wolverines, meanwhile, returned to Damascus for another meeting with the flummoxed minister, dropped off the rental SUV, and flew out to Abu Dhabi the next day. No trace, no flap, no fuss, courtesy of the Wolverines. Damascus Station breathed a sigh of relief, the grandees at Langley preened, and Forsyth had his Wolverine team intact. The Wolverines remained on active duty for another 3 years, but with their sponsor and advocate Tom Forsyth assigned abroad and then headquarters bound, they were eventually retired and were paid their sizable annuities that had accrued over the years. There was an awkward award ceremony in headquarters during which the five Wolverines were presented with individual Distinguished Service Medals, a meritorious unit citation, as well as engraved brass and wood mantel clocks with a world time bezel and CIA logo on the face. The presenter who read the citations, she had been born the year Vitold had eluded the guard dogs in the Campinos forest outside Warsaw, had a little trouble with the Polish names, but the deputy director had memorized gratulacje, congratulations in Polish, which he kept repeating while shaking hands. Thanks to their performance in Syria, Forsyth kept the Wolverines on the reserve list, but there was only intermittent work, and they all eventually dispersed to comfortable, if spiritless, retirements. Three returned to Poland and their families. Agnes, the only woman of the network, was single, earthy, and still a wild child. She settled in Southern California and found work restoring art at the Getty Museum. Vitold, forever serious and driven and chronically unmarried, chose to live in New York, where he occasionally did freelance security consulting. So Forsyth's unexpected call for the Wolverines to pack their bags and meet in New York City was the long-hoped-for recall from their blancmange existences. The rendezvous was set at the exclusive Tiro Aseño Club, established 1888 on Mulberry Street in the village, where Vitold, thanks to his Italian citizenship, was a member. It was a special place. The club's facade of 3 nondescript brownstones was identified only by a brass plaque and a red canopy. The entrance foyer was graced by 2 antique shotguns hung on the wall. The adjoining barroom, sitting rooms, and card rooms were all wood and leather, and the table in the billiard room was gorgeous in orange felt. The dining room was bathed in subdued lighting from copper bowl pendants, and the intimate tables sparkled with crystal and white linen. The air of the club was heavy with fragrant savory things going on in the Italian kitchen. Members of Tiro, as it was called, knew one another and nodded politely. Vitold had booked the narrow private room with a table that could seat 30, and had ordered a simple dinner of buttery imported mozzarella di bufala with prosciutto, a sinfully rich lobster risotto, and fresh fruit for dessert. The Wolverines were all there early, greeted by Vitold with a glass of Prosecco. Their faces lighted up when Forsythe entered the room, and the Poles moved to shake his hand and buss him on both cheeks, a happy Cold War reunion. It had been too long. Faces turned again to the door as Nate Nash walked into the room, attentive and fit, dark and intense. Nash wore a blazer over a pinstripe shirt with a dark blue tie. The Wolverines made their individual canny assessments. Vitold carefully observed how Forsythe addressed Nash to gauge the young man's status. Richard, the former army captain, watched how Nash made eye contact when speaking. Piotr, the former police sergeant, registered the strength of Nash's handshake. Agnes, from afar, appraised Nash's shoulders under his blazer. "You all have been lazing around," said Forsythe. "We have work to do." Piotr, the ex-cop, huffed. "You kept us waiting long enough," he said. "I wasn't sure you hadn't grown fat and slow in retirement," said Forsythe, deadpan. "Piotr is the fattest," said Jersey, the electronics whiz. "Too much sernik, Polish cheesecake." "Do not worry about me," said Piotr. "You should worry about losing your hair." The rangy Jersey's hair was thinning on top. "Thomas, as you can see, discipline is as bad as ever," said Richard. "These worthless fellows have not changed." "Enough," said Vitold, always in command. "Thomas, tell us what work you have for us." He was ever the aristocrat dressed in a light charcoal double-breasted suit. "Russia, the Crimea, Sevastopol." "Phenomenalny, marvelous," said Richard. "The weather will be warm and sunny." "How long?" asked Vitold. He sipped his Prosecco, looking at Nate over the rim of his glass. 2 days, three. The target is a warehouse," said Forsythe. Faces turned to Nate again. "But first tell us something of this young man," said Agnes. She was tall and sharp-featured, with gray eyes and thick black hair that fell to her shoulders. She had a snow-white streak in her hair, a white forelock that began at the forehead and swept back. She was wearing a black-knit sweater dress that clung to a body that hinted at Mount Rushmore. "This is Nathaniel Nash," said Forsythe. "I've worked with him for 6 years. He will be coordinating the operation." The Poles were silent. "Coordinating or leading?" said Piotr. "Leading. He has significant experience in denied area operations," said Forsythe. "May I ask where?" said Vitold softly. Forsythe knew this wasn't going to be easy. "Moscow," said Nate, speaking for the first time. "Helsinki, Rome, Athens." Agnes thought he was attractive, the confident man-boy. "Vy govoriti po-ruski?" asked Richard. "Do you speak Russian?" "I studied in college and kept it up afterward," said Nate in Russian. The Poles instantly heard in his accent and phrasing that he was fluent, probably better than any of them. "He's the best officer I've seen on the street ever," said Forsythe. Nate looked at his shoes. "Yeah, good on the street, my ass in a sling," he thought. Piotr sipped his drink, and Agnes tilted her head, still looking at him. "Thomas, forgive me, but I'm thinking Pani Nathaniel, Mr. Nate, is too young to be that good," said Piotr. Heads turned. Everybody knew Piotr the cop. He was testing. Forsythe held his breath. "Come on, Nash," he thought. "If I agreed with you," said Nate in colloquial Russian, looking Piotr in the eyes, "we'd both be wrong." There was a moment of silence, then Vitold held out a glass to Nate. "Care for some Prosecco?" he said. After the mozzarella, they had 25 minutes before the risotto would reach the final mantecatura stage, where the cold butter is stirred into the finished rice, so Vitold suggested they go down to the basement firing range. The name Tiro a Segno, in fact, means shooting gallery, and the incongruous 50-yard range with three leather-padded firing points was popular with members. Piotr looked at Nate and pointed to the bolt-action rimfire rifles at two of the shooting positions, put on earmuffs, slapped the four-round magazine into the rifle, and worked the bolt to jack around into the breech. Nate did the same, and both men rested their elbows on the leather padding and looked through the sighting scopes. The paper targets were simple three-ring bullseyes hung on tracked clips that could be run the length of the spotlighted range, to vary distances or to be retrieved up close for inspection. Agnes moved to stand behind Nate and whispered, "Udachi," good luck, in Russian. The little rifles popped and each target flapped as the 22 rounds tore ragged holes in the center of the paper. Excellent, tight groups on both bullseyes. At the fourth shot, both Forsyth and Vitold saw Nate's rifle barrel waver for a second. The rifles were safed and the targets run back to the firing line. Nate's target was perfect. All the rounds had gone through the same expanded hole in the smallest ring. There was a bellow from Piotr. His target had a hole outside the rings, near the edge of the paper. A disastrous flyer. Nate shook Piotr's hand with a serious expression. Piotr looked over at Forsyth and Vitold, who were smirking, red-faced. He looked back at Nate, who was still serious, but his eyes were twinkling. Piotr finally got it. Nate had shot across the lanes to place the apparent pulled shot into Piotr's target, an old rangemaster's prank Gable had once pulled on Nate himself. Piotr held on to Nate's hand, glowering. "Beres druzhno ne budet gruzhno," said Nate in Russian. "If all of us take hold of it together, it won't feel heavy." Piotr clapped Nate on the shoulder. "Now I will buy you a drink," he said. Zrazi zawijane, Polish roulade of beef. Pound slices of round steak very thin. Put thin-sliced onions and pickle and a finger of trimmed French bread on each slice, roll tightly, and secure with toothpicks. Boil dried mushrooms in beef stock. Roll beef rolls in flour and brown in butter with additional onions in a Dutch oven. Cover rolls with stock and bake until beef is tender and braising liquid has reduced to a rich gravy. Chapter 17. Phase 1. The narrow S-shaped Balaclava harbor on the southern coast of the Crimean Peninsula was too short to be called a fjord. Protected by craggy headlands topped by the ruins of a Genoese fort built in 1365, the sun-baked little harbor was flanked by empty warehouses and two sleepy restaurants with tables and umbrellas. At the end of the harbor, on the west side, yawned a decrepit concrete adit that was the entrance to a defunct Soviet underground submarine base with a 500-meter channel built under the mountain during the Cold War to shelter Red Fleet submarines from nuclear attack. Clustered on the hills above the east side of the harbor were newer buildings of the town, including the red-tile-roofed Dakar Resort Hotel with stone balconies overlooking the Little Jewel Harbor. At night, under the riotous Crimean stars, the few city lights glittered on the still water. Nate and the Wolverines sailed into Balaclava Harbor at midnight, on a 52-foot trunk cabin cruiser with a dark blue hull and graceful varnish topsides. The leased yacht with two crew from CIA's maritime branch had departed from Varna, Romania, and in 2 days had navigated 300 nautical miles out of sight of land, directly to Balaclava Bay on the placid Crimean coast of pine-covered peaks and rocky islets. The boat backed into an empty slip at the modest Golden Symbol Yacht Club, too late to check in with the authorities. The next morning, uninterested Ukrainian customs officers recorded the Polish alias passports of the passengers on a coast-wide holiday cruise. Instead of staying aboard the yacht, the passengers booked 6 rooms at the Dakar Hotel and spent the rest of the day exploring the little town, climbing the hill to the castle ruins and taking the organized tour of the underground submarine pens, now a museum. By the end of the day, they had satisfied themselves that there was no coverage of them by local police or regional security services. It had been a consideration that Nate, known by Moscow FSB as a CIA officer, technically was in Russian-controlled Crimea, but he was anonymous in the company of the team. They ate at the crowded Café Argo, dipping crusty bread into vermilion Georgian beet salad spread, squeezing lemons over shashlik, sizzling lamb kebab sprinkled with wild oregano, chased by ice-cold Levitsky beers. The Wolverines were watchful but at ease. Steady nerves, top pros. Nate tried to tamp down his anticipation, the edginess he always felt before an op. He saw Agnes looking at him from down the table, sensing his mood. Tomorrow they would go active, travel to Sevastopol, and break into the warehouse. Diva had reported the address from Moscow. Nate and the Wolverines had rehearsed how they would tag the crates with quick plant beacons, and Nate saw how good they were. So good, in fact, that they expanded the original plan. He had bonded with the Poles during the 2 days of training. Vitold and Richard, rigidly proper, brainy Jersey, well, brainy, and gruff Piotr, a Polish version of Gable. Agnes had kept looking at Nate, categorizing him, sizing him up. Now in Balaclava she appeared calm and collected. Perhaps the only sign of pre-op nerves was her habit of twisting a strand of her thick hair around a finger. An hour later, Nash stood on the darkened balcony of his hotel room before going to bed, looking at the black harbor and the starlight on the hills across the water. Dominica. He would see her soon, if nothing went wrong in the next 2 days. He played in his head what he would say to her in Istanbul. Gable would be hovering, watching them, his big sheepdog head turned into the wind, sniffing. Jesus, he wanted to hold Dominica in his arms, put his hands on her back, and pull her tight against him. If he did that, Gable would feed him to the lions. He knew, just knew, however, that Dominica would fly into a rage if he fended her off. She had done so before. She was of the view that she could be a spy and still be in love with her CIA handler, whom she desired. And she did not sympathize one bit with his conundrum that his superiors disapproved of their doing what they both most wanted to do. She would see to it he was not fired. If they loved each other, that should be enough. "If you love me, then nothing else matters," Dominica had told him. Nate resented being in this situation, resented Benford looking over his shoulder all the time, resented Gable's acuity, resented Dominica's damn Russian incorrigibility. And tomorrow he and his team would break into a warehouse in broad daylight and futz with anti-personnel explosives designed to blow them up. "Chill. What's the matter with you?" he thought. He heard his door latch click and turned to see a sliver of hallway light widen, then go dark again. Someone was in his room. FSB? Had he missed hostile coverage today? Breathe, heartbeat up. Nate moved quietly off the balcony, reaching for the heavy glass ashtray on the side table. He smelled perfume and his stomach flipped. No way. Agnes came out of the shadow into the bar of starlight slanting across the room. She was wearing a baggy sleep shirt and was barefoot. "The locks on these doors are ridiculously easy," she said. Nate swallowed. "Agnes, what are you doing? Are you all right?" He knew the answer. "I always am a little nervous before an operation," she said. "Aren't you?"
"Nervous about what?" asked Nate.
"Well, not nervous, exactly," said Agnes, running her fingers through her hair.
"What exactly?" said Nate.
"More like amorous," she said.
"Amorous?"
"As in horny," she said, stepping toward him. She touched his cheek.
"Agnes," said Nate, "this is not a good idea. We have work tomorrow."
"It will steady our nerves," she said, trailing her hand down his chest.
"My nerves are fine," said Nate.
Her perfume was citrusy and made his head swim. She was exotic and primal. He could feel the heat of her hand through his shirt, and he felt dizzy. Benford, Gable, Domi, regulations, kicked out of CIA, separated from the service, the citrus and musk bloom of this busty tuning fork named Agnes standing a foot away, breathing on him. His arms involuntarily moved a fraction. He knew that in 3 seconds he was going to twist his fingers in that mane of hair with the white forelock and crush their mouths together. He could see the rise and fall of her breasts under her shirt. The bottom hem vibrated as her body trembled. 3,
two, one, fuck. Stop. His hands stayed at his sides. Agnes took her hand off his chest, stepped back, and shook her hair. I'm thinking about the team, that's all. About us doing this right, said Nate. So shall I go? Agnes said. Nate took her hot hand in his. He didn't want her to leave mad. The last thing they needed in hostile territory. You're incredibly beautiful and sexy, but don't you think it's not the right thing? I think it is the right thing, she said flatly. She turned and slipped out the door without a sound. Jesus, she's furious. Nate woke up an hour later, his room pitch black, the smell of citrus in his nose again. He felt Agnes slip naked under the single sheet, mash her breasts against his chest, and swing a leg over his hip. He registered a soft wetness on his leg. Her skin was feverish, and she breathed into his ear. I have changed my mind, she said. The white streak in her hair fell across his face. The bustling port city of Sevastopol simmered under the Crimean sun. Its eight scalloped inlet harbors were bordered by war memorial parks, pebbly public beaches, and elegant whitewashed mansions. Farther inland, high-rise apartment blocks were squeezed between thoroughfares clogged with traffic. In the largest of the harbors, Sevastopol Bay, were the massive concrete piers of the Russian Black Sea Fleet, a dozen bristling gray hulls moored stern to. Sevastopol was 12 kilometers from Little Balaklava, over the mountains. At noon, Nate and the Wolverines took the No. 9 Marshrutka bus from Balaklava Harbor to the 5-kilometer exchange outside Sevastopol, and then rode the No. 14 city bus to the Omega beach stop at the bottom of Krula Bay. The route had been charted by headquarters photo analysts who had walked the entire 12 kilometers via digital satellite imagery. The small buses were crowded, and Nate shared a seat with Agnes, who that morning looked as if she had ridden a long distance on horseback, which was not entirely inaccurate. As the others dozed in the hot, swaying bus, Agnes pushed her thigh against Nate's. "When do I meet your parents?" Agnes said in Russian. Nate closed his eyes. "Agnes, stop kidding around." He was experiencing remorse on two levels. Sleeping with Agnes, a member of the team that he was leading with a sensitive job ahead, was reckless. Sleeping with her weeks before he was going to see Dominica was worse. It had been as if he were observing himself from an opposite corner of the room, unable to control events. Fuck. Had he weakened, maybe as a way of defying his scolding superiors? Maybe to create some space between him and Domi. Go ahead, he thought, rationalize your ass off. Agnes had been active and insistent, clapping her own hand across her mouth so as not to wake the whole hotel. Wet-lipped, she had held his face in her hands and whispered, "Jesta taka slizna," you are very beautiful, in Polish, without Nate's knowing what she had said. Now she was the debauched older woman with a morning-after glow, having fun. "I never told you I can bake," she whispered. "What kind of cake do you like?" "I'm not listening to you," said Nate. Secretly, he was amused and interested. This woman, from her early 20s, had risked everything fighting in the shadows for her country. She was second only to Witold in planning sessions, and it was obvious that he respected her. During training, Benford had once glowered at her, and she had glowered back, earning Benford's grudging approval. Nate had seen hurt in her eyes only once, when Piotr had teased her about becoming an old maid. She was different, strong-willed, and passionate. "Oh, yes, I feel marvelous this morning," she said, conversationally. "You're quite a musician, do you know that?" she said. She pushed sweat-damp hair off the back of her neck and fanned herself with a piece of cardboard. Nate shook his head. "Let's concentrate on today. We're not clear until we're on the boat tonight and outside the 12-mile limit." "Don't worry, I'm ready." "We are all ready," Agnes said. She put her hand on his arm. "We will succeed. You will see." Nate did indeed see. From the Omega beach stop, the team walked separately and casually down busy 6-lane Myachina Street, mingling with afternoon shoppers and citizens heading home. Three carried backpacks over their shoulders, the other three carried well-used zippered shopping totes seen in open-air markets. They maintained the same distances from each other that surveillance would take, in effect becoming their own counter-surveillance. Halfway down the boulevard, they peeled off into three pairs. The first crossed a vacant lot, the second walked through leafy courtyards between apartment blocks, the third ghosted down a dusty lane strewn with garbage. Besides hostile surveillance, they looked for druzhniki, the pensioners sitting on stools in front of apartment blocks who were the unofficial neighborhood watch. Nate was in hyper-detection mode, senses alert, scanning, listening, smelling. Nothing. Maybe the citizens were all at the beach. Status? Black. Time check? Go. They converged from three directions on the four gray metal warehouses, standing in a row on a weed-choked cement apron. The traffic roar on Myachina a block away was barely audible. The buildings were streaked with rust and the roofs sagged. Hand signals from the flankers indicated there was no one around. A bird chirped and a cricket zinged from the weeds. Nate squatted and took a breath. Too quiet? A thought of ambush flickered in his mind. Would the GRU leave munitions unguarded like this? He processed sounds and looked into the shadows under the far trees, all clear. Vitold knelt beside him. "What is it?" said Vitold. The back of his shirt was wet. "How does it feel to you?" said Nate. "I know what you mean," said Vitold. "Doing this in daylight is not normal, but we need the light, and the buses stop at 9. The plan is solid." "Would they leave rockets and mines unattended?" said Nate. "Do not forget these are Russians," said Vitold. "This is the GRU engaged in an illegal operation. They will be determined to keep it secret, especially from the Ukrainian locals." "Alarms? Booby traps?" said Nate. Diva had not reported anything, but she might not have been briefed on such details. "Jersey will check the door and look for motion sensors. They have not made the system he cannot defeat," said Vitold. "Richard will look out for tripwires." Nate signaled and Jersey knelt by the dented tin side door and ran his fingers around the edges feeling for protrusions or gaps in the door that could indicate alarm heads on the other side. He shook his head. Nate nodded at Piotr, who picked the tarnished lock with a snake rake and torsion wrench in 15 seconds, then eased the door open an inch while Jersey again ran his fingers along the edges. Negative. Piotr eased the door open, leaned inside, then stuck his head back out and waved them forward. Nate clicked his fingers softly, and the last pair came from the other side. The interior of the warehouse was relatively small. A cracked concrete floor was powdery with a fine gray dust. Rusty vertical steel beams set in the floor supported the latticework roof joists. "Watch footprints, handprints," whispered Nate to Vitold, pointing to the dusty floor. There were no windows along the walls, but milky light came from two bird-spotted skylights. An angular shape in the center of the warehouse was covered by a dark green tarp. The crates.
"Don't touch the tarp," whispered Richard. "It could be wired to pull a fuse."
Nate nodded. He started to walk around the covered mound, but Richard stopped him.
"Shine your light along the floor," he said.
Nate pointed his light, a 250-lumen Nebo slide, in front of him. A double line appeared on the floor, an invisible tripwire and its shadow, running to the closest beam where a black box with a copper cone held by a metal arm was strapped. The cone was like a small megaphone and pointed at the tarp-covered pile.
"SM-70 anti-personnel device," whispered Richard. 80 tiny steel cubes, 25-meter kill zone. They used to put them on the frontier fences."
"Can you defuse it?" said Nate.
"Have to leave it intact. They'd notice if we disarmed it," said Richard. "We have to work in a live kill zone. Take our time. Don't fixate on the tripwire. They want you to follow the line and miss a pressure plate concealed somewhere else. Booby trapping the booby trap."
They slowly peeled the tarp off the crates. The tripwire from the SM-70 disappeared under the near crate.
"Don't lift or move that one," said Richard, pointing.
There were a total of 15 crates of unpainted pine with hinged tops, stamped metal draw bolts, and folding metal handles at each end. There were no stenciled markings of any kind to indicate the contents. The lids and bottoms of each crate were reinforced by wooden skids to facilitate stacking. Nate estimated that 8 of the crates were about 5 feet long. They each looked like a coffin for a child, and would contain the RPG-18 Mooka launchers and the separate propelled grenades. The remaining 7 crates were square and deep with rope handles on the ends. Those would be the mines. Nate and the Wolverine started working silently, their movements coordinated and efficient. Normally, a team of 6 would be too large for this sort of work, but now it meant they could work faster, dividing the tasks. Based on how well they had performed in training, it had been agreed that as well as beaconing the wooden crates, there would be time to render the mines and rockets inert. The black plastic PMN-4 blast mines, each the size of a holiday fruitcake, but only slightly less lethal, were sabotaged by lifting the plunger caps and snipping the points of the firing pins flush to the Belleville spring plungers. The snipped pins would never contact the detonators for each mine's main charge of 55 grams of high-velocity RDX. The rocket-propelled grenades nestled in wooden cradles 6 to a crate were fixed by the simple expedient of trickling 3 drops of superglue into each detent hole to freeze the actuator to the secondary rocket motor that guided the round to its target. Surprised PKK gunners would now aim the launchers, pull the triggers, and gape at projectiles that farted out of the tube for 3 feet and rolled around on the sidewalk harmless. Agnes and Vitold, meanwhile, had emptied the contents of the backpacks and laid them in a row on the floor. They were duplicate wooden skids that would be switched to replace the original cleats. Each new skid had been mortised and was filled with 2 beacons, one a short-range hammer proximity beacon, designed for use in dense urban environments, the other a quick-hatch geolocation beacon that reported long-range position via GPS satellite. With quick-hatch, you could follow a camel across the Sahara from a laptop in Manhattan. With great care, the original skids were unscrewed and the hot replacements were fastened in place with silent push screwdrivers. Agnes was a marvel, collecting discarded wood, counting tools, and ensuring the crates were left exactly as they found them by comparing photos she had taken with her cell phone at every stage of the operation. Once verified, the pics would be deleted. The afternoon sun was dimming, and Nate looked at his watch. He didn't want to work by flashlight. Vitold saw him, smiled, and mouthed, 5 minutes more. Nate took a cautious walk around the outside, still worried by the prospect of a trap not yet sprung, but the zone around the warehouse was clear. Nothing moved. He went back inside and Agnes was waiting near the door, out of earshot of the other Wolverines. "We are almost finished," she said, smiling. "Everything went smoothly." Nate nodded.
"You guys do good work," said Nate. "Forsyth thinks your team is the best, and so do I."
Agnes smoothed her hair.
"Do you think we leave tonight or tomorrow?" she asked.
"If we get back at a reasonable hour, there's no reason not to leave tonight, as if we're taking a moonlight cruise," said Nate.
"I just wondered if we'd be in the hotel another night," said Agnes, looking at him with her gray eyes.
"Oh, no," said Nate, shaking his head. "Don't start, Agnes."
"That little boat will be cramped with all of us aboard, no privacy."
Nate tried to imagine Agnes naked in a narrow upper berth, with Piotr snoring in the lower rack.
"I thought the start of an operation made you feel this way," said Nate. "It's over. We're finished. Sometimes before a mission, sometimes after," she said, sighing. "Sometimes during."
Nate reached out and took her hand.
"What am I going to do with you?" he said. She squeezed his hand. "Do I have to tell you, or can you guess?"
The Wolverines finished their work, leaving the pile of crates as they found them and draping the tarp exactly as it had been, according to digital photos Agnes had taken of the warehouse interior before they started. They blew smudgy footprints away and raised a cloud of dust that evenly coated crates, tarp, and floor as before. Nate checked Agnes's photos to verify the scene. She stood close to him holding the camera, the heat from her body palpable, and they backed out and watched Jersey relock the door and wipe surfaces clean. Not that the Russians would be dusting for prints, considering the haphazard way they had cached the munitions. The swaying bus ride back to Balaclava through the Crimean dusk seemed to take longer. Nate listened for sirens and the sound of motorcycles coming up from behind, and he strained to focus far ahead at the curves, looking for the striped sawhorses of a roadblock, cars angled across the road. Nothing. They stayed below to reduce the profile as the cruiser slowly moved away from the pier, down the harbor, past the sea buoy, and into open water. It was night now, the horizon to the west still a little light, the blackness to the east and south impenetrable. The crew signaled Nate when they had gone 12 miles outside Putin's territorial waters, and Pyotr opened a bottle of Slivovica, and they stood close together on the after deck and drank under the stars. Agnes contrived to bump shoulders with Nate as Richard sang Hey Sokoli, Hey Falcons from the Polish-Soviet War. The cruiser rolled in the gentle sea swell. Phase 1 finished, thought Nate, 2 and 3 coming up. Istanbul, Gable, Dominica. Georgian beet salad. Put boiled beets, pitted prunes, garlic, walnuts, and sour cream in a food processor and pulse to a grainy paste. Garnish with rough chopped walnuts and cilantro. Serve with crusty bread. Chapter 18. Phase 2. Nate's primary liaison contact in the TNP was a 30-year-old captain named Hanefi. He was short and dark, with a single caterpillar eyebrow and a thick black mustache, which would twist sideways whenever he was agitated. He was learning English and tried to use it at every opportunity. The backs of Hanefi's hands were something out of Phantom of the Opera, burned during an explosion, and he self-consciously hid the shiny disfigurement by keeping them in his pockets. Nate and Hanefi worked well together, but not before the intense police officer began trusting Nate. Gable had warned him about working with Turks. No recruitment attempts, no case officer moves, not even if one of them volunteers. They take their time warming up, but once they're satisfied you're not working them, they're your friends for life. But if they later catch you trying to pick their pockets, they'll never forgive or forget. Nate spent hours with Hanefi, listening to telltaps of Shlikov on the phone with Moscow and various PKK cell leaders. Russian and fractured English were used, discussing the upcoming weapons delivery. For an officer of his rank, Shlikov's comsec, sense of communication security over the phone, was non-existent. Each careless call to a separatist would identify 5 more members, those 5, 10 more. Each identified location led to the next 2, then the next 3, all of them in Istanbul's sooty suburbs. Çebeci Alibeykoy Guzultepe, an apartment in a rust-stained high-rise, a daub and wattle shed on a muddy lane, or a sagging farmhouse in a garbage-choked gully. There were so many sites that additional police units were brought in from Ankara to assist in surveilling all the locations. Then the munitions arrived, and a TNP helicopter with a Hyena receiver vectored TNP surveillance teams. They were as good as Nate had ever seen anywhere, to warehouses where the explosives would be stored before dispersal. The patient Turks set up on each location, watching, marking suspects. A coordinated assault plan was finalized. The Turks were impressed with Nate's beacons. They were a marvel, said Hanefi. How did you do it, Nate Bey? Asked Hanefi late one night in a smoke-choked listening post referring to the crates. Nate smiled. If you asked me whether we did it in Russia, I couldn't tell you, said Nate. Hanefi put back his head and laughed. Aferin sen Osmanli, said Hanefi. He meant, bravo, you're an Ottoman, a righteous stud. The night of the multiple raids, Nate checked quick-hatch beacon readouts from a terminal in the consulate. That technology was not releasable to the Turks, they were unaware of the redundant system, but all locations were corroborated 100%. Benford called on the secure phone and uncharacteristically praised Nate's performance both in Sevastopol and in working with the Turks in Istanbul, which he called satisfactory. Benford confirmed that the tech team for Phase 3 would arrive the next day. Part of Nate's plan to frame Shlikov had already been running for a time, a denigration ploy so insidious that a chuckling Gable had said Shlikov was already screwed, only he didn't know it yet. Good luck tonight, Benford had said, then terminated the secure link. Nate hung up, remembering that Agnes had also wished him good luck after the Wolverines returned by boat to Varna. He didn't know it, but Agnes had booked a flight a day later than the rest of the team. Nate, likewise, was waiting for his flight to Istanbul and was staying one night at the Central Hotel, a tired Romanian Black Sea resort where the lobby, corridors, and rooms smelled of hot elevator oil. Agnes had